She represents the Alaska Native determination to hold on to their way of life.
Remembering subsistence rights pioneer Katie John from the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 31st. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the election is more than a year away, but the race for Senator Begich's seat is heating up.
It is an election against the president, but a little bit broader than that, it's an election against D.C.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Athabascan elder, who was the lead plaintiff in a lawsuit that strengthened Native subsistence fishing rights in Alaska, has died. Katie John passed away early this morning at the Alaska Native Medical Center in Anchorage. She was 97 years old. John and the Mentasta Village Council sued the United States government in federal court in 1985 when the Alaska Board of Fisheries did not allow them to fish at an abandoned fish camp in an area which is now part of Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. The suit claimed the federal government had unlawfully excluded subsistence fishing from the protections of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. The judge ruled in John's favor in 1994. The state of Alaska battled that ruling, but in early 2001, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the ruling. Later that year, then-governor of Alaska, Tony Knowles, announced he would not fight the Ninth Circuit decision before the United States Supreme Court. In an interview with APRN in 2001, a delighted Katie John said the governor told her of his decision in person.
This morning he called, he said, no more. You got everything, he told me. So I was so happy. I was pretty sick too this morning, and for a couple of days I've been sick, I got cold. So when he talked to me, oh, in the case, I just jumped around. I forgot my sickness.
At the time, Knowles said he had made his decision because the litigation was only widening the gap between urban and rural Alaskans.
I think anyone that would talk to Katie John and to look at what she does would believe that what she does is right. It's not wrong. To provide for her family in the best way that she knows how is right for her, her family, and for the thousands of other families from Metlakatla to Bethel to Norvik, that this is something the state must support. You know, we have to stop that losing legal strategy that we have pursued for 10 years and stop the permanent divide that it has threatened to cause among Alaskans.
Native American Rights Fund attorney Heather Kendall Miller, who represented John in court, says John will continue to be a role model for Alaska Natives.
She represents the Alaska Native determination to hold on to their way of life that is intimately connected to the land and is a very rich and rewarding life that has become known as subsistence way of life. And she wanted to pass on those customs and traditions to her family and her children and her community. And that's what she spent her life doing.
John received an honorary Doctor of Laws degree from the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 2011 for her advocacy of Indigenous rights and her ongoing efforts as a teacher of culture and language. Dr. Jim Carey with the Alaska Native Language Center in Fairbanks worked with Katie John on efforts to preserve Alaska Native languages by developing an alphabet of the Otna dialect.
One memorable statement by Katie John is, everything I know, I keep in my head. Just this morning in Gulkana, I spoke briefly with Chief Fred Ewan, who said this, "We lost the best woman we ever had."
John raised 14 children and 6 adopted children with her husband, Mentasta Traditional Chief Fred John. Family members have not released plans for a funeral yet. The next U.S. Senate race in Alaska is still 18 months away, but a number of Republicans have already jumped into the race or are publicly mulling taking on Senator Mark Begich in November of 2014. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, they're likely to have a long, drawn-out primary campaign first.
Virtually everyone in Washington agrees the Republicans need to win Alaska to take back control of the Senate. It's one of the 6 most closely watched races. So far, the only official challenger to Begich is Joe Miller. Miller, who beat Senator Lisa Murkowski in the 2010 primary but lost in the general election, filed his intent to run May 2nd.
It is an election against the president, but a little bit broader than that, it's an election against D.C. D.C. is just simply, and I'm talking both sides of the aisle, turned its back on the American people.
Republicans plan on tying Begich to the National Party. He serves in the Democratic leadership of the Senate. The National Republican Senatorial Committee, the wing of the GOP tasked with winning the Senate, is trying to make the 2014 race about President Barack Obama's health care bill. That law was largely upheld by the Supreme Court, but many across the country are deeply skeptical of it. Senator Begich does not shy away from his vote for the bill. He likes to highlight popular elements of it.
Pre-existing conditions are no longer a reason to deny for insurance. Seniors are going to get better reimbursements on their prescription drugs. Alaska Native healthcare system was finally reauthorized after 19 years of pending in the U.S. Senate and House, and now it's permanently reauthorized.
Jennifer Duffy is senior editor at the Cook Political Report, a nonpartisan newsletter that analyzes races. She says early signs show the 2014 race will play out like most midterm races, with low turnout, and the party out of power gets more voters to the polls.
Obviously, one of the things we're going to be looking at is what Democrats are doing to help Senator Begich put together the kind of voter identification and get out the vote program that was so helpful to President Obama in 2012.
Duffy says one major voting block to watch will be Alaska Natives, a group that assisted Murkowski's write-in victory. For his part, Miller says he's working on Alaska Native outreach and plans on having a stronger rural election strategy this go-around. Miller would need to win the Republican primary to face Begich. That's not until August 2014, and he won't have an easy path. Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell will make his decision in June. He says he's intensified his exploration of a run since Governor Sean Parnell said he'll seek re-election. Treadwell cannot run concurrently for lieutenant governor and Senate.
I've certainly enjoyed serving as lieutenant governor. I've worked hard to help the governor's agenda, and I believe we're on the right track in being more competitive and attracting industry to our state, long-term jobs to the state.
So he says the remaining big issues are federal.
Our biggest problems are access issues to our land in Washington. Not sure we're getting the results we need to get.
That's an argument every candidate and would-be candidate makes. Begich, Treadwell, Miller, and Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan, who's rumored to be mulling a bid as well. Miller says Alaska's resource development will be the theme of his campaign, despite the commonalities with the others.
Well, I think there's a lot of similarity in resources. I don't think there's much doubt about that.
He says his unwillingness to vote for the heads of agencies that regulate federal land sets him apart. Whoever wins the GOP primary will face a well-financed Begich. He's sitting on more than $1.5 million cash on hand. Miller has a little more than $400,000, and he's just now starting to fundraise. He didn't take in any donations in the first quarter of this year. By all accounts, Begich is a prolific fundraiser. He says he averages 2 to 3 hours on the phone every day asking for money.
In this world we live in, you have to be realistic about the amount of resources you need to run. And I have no problems picking up the phone and calling people to ask for help and support.
And in the era of more lax campaign finance laws, that will be more important than ever. Begich cannot assume whoever survives a long, bruising GOP primary will be too beaten to win the general election, because any outside group can come in and prop up any candidate. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A state court judge says the Alaska Redistricting Board should immediately begin redrawing the state's political boundaries. Superior Court Judge Michael McConaughey, in a tartly worded order, also said the board must hold public hearings on whatever it comes up with. McConaughey has been presiding over challenges to the redistricting plan. He said Alaska is no closer to having, quote, constitutional voting districts than it was in February of 2012. When he found several districts were unconstitutional as drawn, or last December when the Alaska Supreme Court ordered the map be redrawn for next year's elections. Board Chairman John Torgerson has said the panel intends to wait for a U.S. Supreme Court decision on provisions of the Federal Voting Rights Act before redrawing the map. McConaughey says the board doesn't need to wait. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making instruments in Anchor Point the old-fashioned way.
There's modern stuff, but there's a reason why, like, the 1960s Martin sounds so nice.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
A fire in the Matanuska Susitna Borough has spread to 45 acres and destroyed one cabin in its path. Hotshot crews have been called in from Kenai to help battle the blaze. Norm McDonald, state fire management officer for the area, says the fire was reported at about 10 acres around 6:30 yesterday evening.
Right now, the suspected cause is an escape campfire.
Last night, state firefighters made airdrops of 2,000 gallons of fire retardant, attempting to slow the fire's spread. A helicopter also dropped buckets of water on the fire, which is not accessible by road. Crews are being shuttled in on ATVs to a point off Point McKenzie Road.
One crew, Gannett Glacier, and a Helitech crew, so a total of about 18 people. We have a second crew, Pioneer Peak, coming out of Kenai. It should be arriving on scene this afternoon, and we'll keep both crews on it for the next several days till we have the fire contained and out.
Low humidity and warm weather are not helping the effort to control the fire, but McDonald says no other structures are in danger at this time.
Yeah, right now we're calling about 10% contained. They do have the main fire knocked down, although just with the fuel types and the heavy snags and standing dead trees in the area, it's difficult to get it fully contained until we get all those trees down and put out.
McDonald reminds people that there is a burn ban in place in the Matsu Borough. A lawsuit against the National Marine Fisheries Service has been settled in district court in Anchorage. As KDLL's Shaylin Cochran reports, native and environmental groups took issue with some of the math the agency used in calculating how many Cook Inlet beluga whales would be affected by seismic testing for oil and gas.
Specifically, the use of high-pressure air guns that sound like this. NIMS issued permits to Apache Corporation for that kind of testing last year, but the plaintiffs group in this case didn't like the way the agency projected the number of whales that might swim through these testing zones. Rebecca Noblin is the Alaska director for the Center for Biological Diversity. They joined the Chicoloon Native Village and the Natural Resources Defense Council as plaintiffs.
They really underestimated how many whales might be harmed.
The plaintiffs group logged several complaints about the permits, but this is the only one that stuck. Now, the real problem is that they based the number of whales that would be affected on an aerial survey, but didn't correct that estimate for whales that can't be observed in an aerial survey. Brad Smith is the agency's Protected Resources Field Office Supervisor in Anchorage.
So that correction factor was used for the overall estimate of the whales in the inlet for our population estimate, but it was not used when we estimated the actual animals that were in this area that would be affected by the project.
So because there were some errors in those calculations, the court found that the agency's limit for takes of whales was arbitrary and capricious. That limit was 30 whales per year, about 10% of the total population of Cook Inlet belugas. Now, a take in this circumstance doesn't necessarily mean a kill. The permits issued are called IHAs, Incidental Harassment Authorization. That can mean a couple of different things, but basically it means disturbing a marine mammal by conduct ranging from incidental harassment to killing. And for Apache's part, they did have a mitigation plan in place that NIMS was okay with. If belugas started to swim into a testing area, they would pause or stop testing.
They would have the observers on board the seismic vessel with binoculars and looking during daylight hours when visibility allowed them to see whether whales were coming in with this zone at the point where they may be harassed.
And beside that, Smith says belugas tend to cluster, usually where they can get a fill of salmon near river mouths and not necessarily near the testing zones. He says one testing zone is in an area where no whales have been observed by aerial survey.
That's not to say that we wouldn't expect them to be found or to occur in the area where we expected the seismic, most of the seismic noise to be found during the surveys, but rather the distribution is going to be clustered, and then most of the whales are not going to be in this area, but rather at the mouths of those salmon streams.
Smith says they've reworked the math, and Apache is operating under a new batch of permits. Noblin says a new approach is needed, that the focus of the agency should be more precautionary and look at all of the activity going on in Cook Inlet. Apache isn't the only company doing business out there, and oil and gas development isn't the only activity.
There's shipping, and there's pollution from Anchorage, and there's all sorts of things going on in Cook Inlet that can impact beluga whales, and the National Marine Fisheries Service is the only agency that really, can get a handle on everything impacting beluga whales and balance all those competing interests.
The permits Apache applied for allow for testing at both 180 decibels and 160 decibels. How loud is that? Well, back when NASA was still in the space shuttle business, they had to use a sound suppression system during launch so that they wouldn't damage the cargo with excessive sound pressure. NASA saw fit to keep the volume below 145 decibels. Reporting in Kenai, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
Fieldwork on a pipeline capable of moving half a billion cubic feet of gas daily is expected to start next week. In an update to legislators yesterday, Frank Richards with the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation explained that they're in the process of trying to figure out the safest place to lay down the pipe, which should stretch down from the North Slope to South Central Alaska. Because the line would cross active seismic areas, workers are mapping the terrain using remote sensing technology.
So we will know if there's the Denali Fault, for instance, is going to potentially move 4 meters during the next event, then we want to make sure that we put in place mitigation for that pipeline so that it can handle that type of movement.
The geotechnical program is expected to go through this summer, with efforts ramping up July 1st. Once the advanced engineering work is done, the plan is to go ahead with an open season where companies can commit to a project that's scheduled to happen next year.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Don't wait to make your home more energy smart. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Home Energy Rebate Program will reimburse you for energy efficiency improvements. And if you don't have the upfront cash to make the investment, financing is available through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Start saving money and energy today. Sign up at akrebate.com or call 877-257-3228. This message sponsored by AHFC.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ann Bryce. This week on AK, making music. In a small white house at the end of a gravel road near Anchor Point, Ray DeMeo has been making instruments in an attached workshop for nearly a decade. He carefully crafts violins, violas, and mandolins, mostly from local wood, some of it found in his own backyard. KBBI's Ariel Van Cleve met up with him recently and has this story.
I walked through the door
and
into the kitchen wood shop area. A large work table sits in the middle of the room. The walls are lined with shelves that hold tools, works in progress, and completed instruments. Ray's first instrument is included in that collection.
I just had an interest when I was a young kid. I grew up in Chicago, and I used to play hooky and hang out in places where they made them and, you know, museums. And I just had an interest. And so I actually started making them in high school. And that was one thing I did in high school, that lute.
Since that lute, he's made another 58 instruments. When he was in high school, Ray would go to one of the libraries in downtown Chicago with pockets full of quarters and copy pages out of the instrument-making reference books. He tried college after high school, but it really wasn't for him. Since then, he's worked in construction, drove truck, served as a soldier, and was a logger in Canada. Eventually, he decided to put his focus back on instruments, so he went back to school to learn to repair violins and violas.
The teacher was a master violin maker, and she taught me at the same time I was learning repair on my own time, kind of. I was able to make a violin with her. You know, she showed me how to make a violin. And then there was a night class at the same time of mandolin making.
Ray also has learned from masters from places like Japan and India. That's translated into a more traditional approach to instrument building, which he says some people shy away from these days.
So I cook my glue. This is just hide glue. Yeah, it's just.
It kind of smells sweet.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It's just from the animal parts.
You make your varnish?
Yeah.
out of what?
You ever hear of lac? It's a bug. And so they leave this hard secretion. And so I buy I use seed lac because it looks like little seeds. And then it's mixed with a couple other things.
Those more traditional methods, like making your own glue, tend to make the business of putting an instrument together that much harder. Everything Ray does has to be deliberate and controlled.
This, you have seconds. You only have a minute at the very top. And a lot of times you'll heat the parts to give it a little extra time. You know, we're talking seconds.
Buddy says the easiest way doesn't always mean you'll get the best result.
There's modern stuff and modern ways and bolts and new kinds of glues. But there's a reason why, like, you know, the 1960s Martins sound so nice. And going even further back in time, you know, the 20s, all mahogany, you know, you could buy them for $30. There's a reason why they sound really good.
Ray couldn't give me an exact time for how long it takes to make each instrument. But from what I saw, it takes a while.
This is how it starts. This is the roughing out of a violin, mandolin, you know, archtop mandolin, cellos, it's all the same. And it starts out just like this.
The sound you're hearing is Ray basically scooping pieces of wood away from the body of what will eventually be his personal viola. And he makes it look really easy.
It's not necessarily the strength, it's the control.
Ray told me the building process starts with selecting a piece of wood. Maple and spruce are pretty typical choices. He draws lines with a pencil on the wood to tell him where not to go, then gets to cutting. Ray says it's part science, part instinct. One way he was testing his work was tapping the board to hear certain tones.
These are tap tones. For viola, the top is C sharp and the back is a D. Mandolins are different. They're a full step away. B sharp, is there such a thing? No.
Isn't that just C?
I'll spare you from listening to the rest of that conversation. It got a little geeky. And that's what's great about Ray. He loves what he does. And you can really tell as you talk to him about his craft, too. And especially when you hear him play an instrument he's made.
I'm making a living at it. It's a pretty cool trade, man.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
In Homer, I'm Ariel Van Cleve.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Golcana on the Richardson Highway, north of Glen Allen.
My name is Angela Vermillion, and I'm the tribal administrator for Golcana Village Council. The village is located in between the Golcana River and the Copper River, and we are located on the Richardson Highway. and we are a small village of between 75 to 100 people. We have spruce trees, and in our background we have the Wrangell Mountains. We've got lots of hills, we've got rivers and creeks. People in Golcana, we are employed. Some work in the Copper River School District, some work for our Native Regional Corporation, and we actually have quite a few people that work here for the Golcana Village Council in various jobs. For fun in the summertime, we're very much involved in our subsistence way of life. We have fish wheels, and a lot of people are involved with fish for the wintertime. We do that in various ways, smoking it, drying it, jarring it, freezing it. And then for fun, people actually, instead of on the fish wheel, they actually go fishing with the fishing pole. There's just a lot of different activities, biking, hiking. We have street lights, and we have paved roads and paved sidewalks, which that's kind of unusual for a smaller village to have all of that.
Angela Vermillion is tribal administrator for the Golcana Village Council. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK. This week we had help from Ariel Van Cleve, Alex Duer, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ann Bryce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tony Gorman in Valdez and Shaylin Cochran in Kenai. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Also, special thanks tonight to archivist Candace Ferguson. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at the AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or a transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.